Welcome to The Week, the weekly news podcast from The Scientist. This edition of The Week is sponsored by Invitrogen. Get free access to more than 900 of John Wiley & Son's current protocols, supporting documentation and related Invitrogen products at the iProtocol online library. Visit www.invitrogen.com/iProtocol. This week, two stories from the Scientist Daily News, one on the surprising winner in the stem cell publication race, and another on how scientists can now watch the production of single proteins in real time. Then, senior editor Jeff Perkel describes the trouble with prefab kits and what you can do to encourage creativity in the lab. First, Ned Stafford writes that to find research on stem cells, look to the Middle East. Israeli scientists are the most prolific authors on a per capita basis of articles published in scientific journals related to stem cell research, with the U.S. lagging in sixth place and the U.K. falling in seventh place, according to a recently published study by the Central Library of the Research Center Jülich in Germany. Raphael Ball, director of Research Center Jülich's Central Library and an author of the study, told The Scientist that the strong showing on a per capita basis of Israel and other small nations indicates a strong national commitment for stem cell research, as well as good use of scientific and financial resources. It could be that the efficiency in the U.S. and other major stem cell nations is not as high as it could be, Ball said. From 2000 to 2004, Israeli scientists published 113 articles for each 1 million citizens, followed by Sweden with 82 articles for each 1 million citizens. Switzerland was next with 76 articles, followed by the Netherlands and Austria, according to the study, which was published in the March issue of the German science magazine Bild der Wissenschaft. Rounding out the top 10 per capita were the U.S. with 47 articles per 1 million citizens, the U.K. with 44 articles, Canada with 41, and Germany and Finland each with 40 articles per 1 million citizens. In terms of total number of stem cell publishing, however, U.S.-based scientists have by far authored the most stem cell articles, some 13,663 in 2000 to 2004, 42% of total articles. Germany came in second with 10.2% of the total, followed by Japan, the U.K., France, Italy, Canada, the Netherlands, Spain, and Sweden. Israeli scientists published 690 articles in 2000-2004. The stem cell publishing data was compiled by the Bibliometric Analysis Unit of Research Center Jülich's Central Library by reviewing titles, abstracts, and keywords of more than 6,000 natural science journals tracked by the Science Citation Index, a database operated by Thomson Scientific. Dov Zipori, based at the Department of Molecular Cell Biology at Israel's Weizmann Institute of Science, told The Scientist that another reason for Israel's strong showing is that the region was home to pioneering studies of bone marrow stem cells in the early 1960s. The fact that the first steps in the development of stem cell studies occurred in Israel formed a platform on which stem cell research developed in Israel, Zipori said. And the Israeli government is financially supportive of this research, he added. We are not restricted to the same extent as our American scientists who are forbidden to derive embryo stem cell lines when using federal funds, Zipori said. Next, correspondent Melissa Lee Phillips writes that papers in Nature and Science have provided the first methods for observing translation of single protein molecules in real time. The studies report two different methods of seeing the synthesis of single protein molecules in live cells, an achievement the authors say will be especially useful for studying proteins found in low copy numbers. The single molecule approach really is a powerful one for studying how proteins are made and operate in live cells, said X. Sunny Z. of Harvard University, senior author of both papers. This process has never been viewed directly in a live cell in real time on a single molecule basis. Researchers have been able to track mRNA transcription at the single molecule level, Z said, but no one has done the same for protein translation. Fluorescence-tagged proteins diffuse around the cytoplasm of live cells, and the signal of one protein will not show up against the cell's background autofluorescence, Z said. In the Science paper, the researchers, also led by Jai Xiao and Jai Yu at Harvard, reveal how they solved this problem. they attach the fluorescent reporter to a membrane protein. This protein attaches to the cell membrane, where its fluorescent signal is kept in one place long enough for its image to be captured. The researchers placed this fusion protein under control of the LAC promoter in Escherichia coli cells. A repressor normally prevents gene expression at this site, but occasionally the repressor stochastically disassociates from the DNA, Z said, allowing brief mRNA transcription. Ribosomes produce a few fluorescent protein molecules before the mRNA degrades and the repressor reattaches. Each time this process produced a fusion protein molecule, the scientists saw a flicker of fluorescence inside the cell. They created time-lapse movies that allowed them to watch as the bacterial cell synthesized new proteins. You can watch an E. coli cell, and suddenly there's a flash of yellow and a protein molecule's just been made, said Kevin Plaxco of the University of California, Santa Barbara, who was not involved in the research, but recently saw the time-lapse movies at a conference. It was very satisfying work. By statistically analyzing more than 60 movies of bacterial protein production, Z and his colleagues determined that just one mRNA molecule is synthesized each time the LAC repressor briefly detaches from the DNA. A short burst of protein production then follows, with a variable number of protein molecules produced each time. The number of protein molecules synthesized from each mRNA molecule follows an exponential decay distribution, a pattern that was first theorized in the 1980s but had never before been experimentally observed, Z said. The pattern likely results from the average lifespan of an mRNA molecule, which also follows an exponential decay distribution, Z said. The single-molecule approach gave them a lot here, Plaxco told the scientist. This is a fundamentally stochastic process, and by looking at it at a single-molecule level, they could see that stochastically what we all knew was there. So this is a very gratifying paper to read. The same pattern of small bursts of protein synthesis was found with a different single-molecule technique reported in Nature by Z and first co-authors Nir Friedman and Long Kai, both also at Harvard. In this study, the researchers used fluorescence generated by the enzyme B. galactosidase as an indirect reporter of gene expression in E. coli cells. When it hydrolyzes a synthetic substrate, a single molecule of B. galactosidase produces many fluorescent molecules, but bumps on the bacterial cell surface expel these molecules too quickly for them to be measured. To get around this, the scientists trapped E. coli cells in microfluidic chambers to prevent the fluorescent molecules from escaping completely. They mounted these chambers on a microscope and found that they could reliably detect the fluorescence generated by the translation of just one molecule of B. galactosidase. When they let the cells grow, they found abrupt, step-like changes in fluorescence in the chambers, indicating small bursts of protein production, just as in the science study. The researchers also used B. galactosidase to measure low-level protein expression in yeast and mouse cells, and they found that their technique worked equally well in these cells. Cells containing different proteins tagged with B. galactosidase can be placed in chambers next to each other and analyzed simultaneously, Z said. Then you'll be able to see different genes turned on and off at the same time. The fused fluorescent protein approach will offer a different advantage: direct imaging of protein translation and movement. The two techniques will provide complementary windows into protein translation, Z told the scientist, but both will really help the characterization of low copy number proteins, including many transcription factors. You don't really get molecular detail with either single molecule approach, said Gerhard Wagner of Harvard University, who did not participate in either study, but it will be useful because there are some things you cannot measure with any other technique. Even for proteins whose crystal structures are known, we want to know how they work in real time, Z said, and that's something the single-molecule technique can do. Finally, the scientist senior editor for technology, Jeff Perkel, says there's a lot wrong with kits, but there's a solution, so to speak.
Jim Allwine was a postdoc at Stanford University in 1975 when Ed Southern published the technique that would come to bear his name. A very bad reprint of Southern's paper was working its way around the biochemistry department, and people were already using the technique in their studies. But Jim Allwine had a different response. Poring over the protocol to understand how it worked, he began to wonder whether it would also work for RNA. The dogma, he says, was that RNA wouldn't bind nitrocellulose, and it doesn't unless you denature it. Good denaturants didn't really exist at the time, but he conquered that by developing a special paper covered with diazo groups that would bind the folded RNA molecules, and they worked very well, he said. Thus was born the Northern Blot. At the time, says Alwine, there were no kits. You had to understand the technologies in deep ways so you could change them to do what you wanted them to do. But that spirit is gone, he says. I think the advent of kits has blunted that creative spirit. And though I'm high on kits, see, for instance, my January column, I tend to agree with him. We increasingly outsource such routine tasks as DNA sequencing, mass spectrometry, and microarrays to core facilities that email results in a day or two. At the same time, we let kits act as technical crutches that dull our ability to interpret experiments and understand where they have gone wrong. In balancing convenience against serendipity, we lose our ability to troubleshoot effectively. Susan Ross, Associate Dean of Biomedical Graduate Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, recalls a master's candidate in her lab whose RNase protection assay failed due to blind adherence to the printed protocol. People become so reliant on following the protocol in the kit, they don't think about the modifications they might have to make, she says. A good principal investigator will insist that his or her student understands kits and instrumentation before allowing them to use them, Ross says, but I think we might more systematically rehone that creative edge at the classroom level. Take the Undergraduate Genomics Research Initiative at the University of California, Los Angeles, for instance, in which students from six different undergraduate courses at UCLA and partnering schools collaborate to sequence the genome of a bacterium, Amanifex degensii. The students prepare and maintain a genomic library, run sequencing reactions, and perform bioinformatics. Lectures cover everything from practical information about the optical configuration of their automated sequencer, a LiCor slab gel-based system, to the BLAST algorithm and its parameters. Program director Cheryl Kerfield makes the education multidisciplinary, working in topics such as biogeochemistry, evolution, microbial metabolism, and microbiology, and comparative genomics. From what Kerfeld says, her students are uncommonly well prepared for work in the scientific trenches. Inevitably, for instance, each quarter someone will have a vertical black line running through his or her sequencing gels, which throws off the base calling software. To figure this out, they really have to think about the migration of the fragments along the vertical, she says, what is fixed, and how the sequencer excites and measures the fluorescence from the dyes incorporated on the primers, and so on, she says. I personally would like to see this model broadened to include microarrays, mass spectrometry, protein purification, and real-time PCR, as well as statistics. And though my sources advocate an undergraduate course, I would implement this program at the graduate level. Second-year grad students should have a level technological playing field, however well-funded their undergraduate institution. Clearly, we can't teach every technology students will ever encounter, nor can we or should we eliminate kits from the lab. But we can change the mindset of budding researchers. Learn how the technology works, understand how the kit functions, and you will be able to adapt it or fix it if you must. The result will be a generation of better-trained scientists.
Join us online at www.the-scientist.com for more of the Scientist Daily News, blogs on current events, controversies and conferences, and features from our March print edition. This edition of The Week was brought to you by Invitrogen. Get free access to more than 900 of John Wiley & Son's current protocols, supporting documentation and related Invitrogen products at the iProtocol online library. Visit www.invitrogen.com/iProtocol.